Do you remember Lee Chapman? Bit of a golden sticker in your panini.
He's a Chapman. Beep, ba, 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 da, boop.
Thomas, it's up for grabs now! Thomas! Right at the end!
Aguero! I swear you'll never see anything like this ever again! So watch it! Drink it in!
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Final Countdown, a podcast looking back at great finals within the game of football. I'm Lewis, here my co-host Adam.
Hello.
Sometimes I wonder if I say that during the night, just as I'm dreaming. It's become second nature
that
now.
That seemed very robotic.
Oh, yeah. I'm just through the motions now. But we do need to get straight into this report, your report, Ad, because I know it's a monstrous year.
It is a monstrous year, for sure. And obviously the season itself we need to cover, because it's been termed the Forgotten Miracle.
Oh, that interestingly enough, I don't remember. So it kind of proves the point, yeah.
I should add, some of this is from a guy called Lee, let me just get this right, Lee Hicken, I think his name was. Yeah, filmmaker Lee Hicken, who made a documentary about this season.
Nice.
Called Do You Really Want to Win? He's a Leeds fan, lifelong Leeds fan. And, you know, spoiler, Leeds win the last Division One title.
Sure.
Before the Premier League came about and football was invented.
Yep, that's right, yeah. Football didn't begin before 92.
That's right, yeah. So he kind of claims, he did like an extensive interview when the film came out. I've never seen the film, but he did an interview. And he talked about the fact that in some ways this was almost as miraculous as what Leicester did.
Ooh.
Now, I think that's a stretch.
Sure.
But I do think there's an element where this came from nowhere.
It's a hell of an achievement.
Yeah, and it was a bit random, really, because obviously Leeds had a bit of a run, didn't they, kind of into the late 90s?
That's right, yeah.
Under Ridsdale and David O'Leary?
Yeah, David O'Leary.
And they had a good team and stuff, and it wasn't really this team.
Yeah.
So there's an element where it's kind of like, okay, yeah, this team is isolated as a success story for 1 year only.
Right, sure.
So I kind of understand.
Yeah, and to be fair, in our reports leading up to this, we haven't really spoken about Leeds.
No, not at all.
So it is a bit of a bolt from the blue in that sense.
Yeah, and they were promoted two seasons before, so slightly less than
Leicester.
But maybe it's because of the monster nature of the Premier League, kind of the big teams,
yeah,
and the establishment of the big six, which was in transition in 2016, but ultimately,
yeah,
Man City, Liverpool, you know, Chelsea, there were big teams around.
Yeah, although, would you say Chelsea were a big team back then? I know they had the occasional cup results.
I thought they won the title in the 2010s.
Oh, yeah, in the 2010s, sorry. Yeah, but I was talking about this era now.
Sorry.
We don't really see an establishment of the big six, do we?
No, not at all. If anything, this is a very, very established change from the order. So on that, Liverpool, who were champions the year before, they finished sixth. Arsenal finished fourth. Liverpool were under Souness.
Yeah.
So the kind of the big teams of the last 4 years.
Yeah.
Shared the title, I think, three times out of the last previous 4 years. Everton were nowhere. They finished 12th, so they were on their downward spiral. So in a way, this is kind of like, oh, all the big teams that were no longer.
Yeah.
Significantly, Leeds' main challenger came from Alex Ferguson's Man United.
Mm.
And they did run them relatively close, but Ferguson has talked about how this season came a season too soon.
Right, okay.
And while he had the framework of a team, you know, in particular, he mentions Cantona, who he bought.
But I was about to say, he's at Leeds for this title win, isn't he?
It's random. He joins in January and is gone by November.
No way.
Yeah, isn't that weird?
You
think he was there longer than that. So he essentially came in, won on the title, then buggered off to Old Trafford.
I mean, I love that. I love that from Cantona. But that is crazy because he gets the LUFC tattooed on the back of his neck. He's only there for like 5 months.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's really random.
Yeah.
So Cantona comes in. So let's kind of like cover this season before we go too far off into the future, because no doubt we will end up there. So on the 26th of April, so relatively late, 1992, Leeds United beat Sheffield United 3-2 at Bramall Lane, and with the news that their challengers Man United lost 2-0 later that afternoon at Anfield, it confirmed Leeds as champions. So they won their last ever league championship before the Premier League was born, as we've mentioned. Leeds' last top division title as well. Although they did okay, as we've mentioned, more in Europe, actually.
Yeah, well, I want to say 2001, 2002. I think it was that feels season, like that. Just before the finances crippled them. They got to the semi-finals of a Champions League. Absolutely incredible.
Yeah, they had Harry Kewell, Woodgate.
Seth Johnson, that's Mark right. Viduka, Alan Smith.
Jason Wilcox, of course. Yeah, Jonathan
Woodgate, like we said. Ian Hart. So I didn't name most of that squad.
Well-known team, but none of them were involved in this. The only player that probably... straddles the two teams is Gary Speed.
Oh, Speed.
Young Gary Speed was in this team in an all-British midfield lineup.
Interesting.
Which Howard Wilkinson, who was the manager, who famously took care.
Yeah, there we go. That's good.
Took care of England for one game.
That's right.
Later on in this decade, he was behind this Leeds team, and he had done an amazing rebuilding job. And so in some ways, it was kind of like a result of the work he did.
Yeah.
It wasn't so much like Ranieri that hadn't really done a rebuilding job on Leicester.
And yeah, yeah.
Wilkerson had really put together this team. So he would argue that this was a result of his hard work. So this all British midfield of Gordon Strachan coming to the end of his career.
Of course, yeah.
David Batty starting out in his career. Gary McAllister, who eventually would end up at Liverpool.
What a season.
And Gary Speed. So that was the kind of the four midfielders.
Just quickly, do you know about David Batty's hatred of football?
No.
He literally resents being a footballer. He doesn't do interviews. Like, you'll notice he never, ever gets mentioned about anything. He's the forgotten man of all the... Think of all the England documentaries, all the interviews, all the programmes about reminiscing about, like, Italian 90, 96
and all Kevin.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He hates football and he's basically a recluse. He doesn't do any interviews now.
How random.
It's so strange.
What he does for money.
Who knows?
Or he lives off of this film.
maybe that's the thing. It's partially funded by him. It's 50%. All the YouTube royalties.
Silent partner. Literally silent.
Literally silent.
So Leeds, amazingly, from their game on October the 1st where they lost to Palace, they went on an unbeaten run that lasted till February.
Wow.
Which basically won them the title.
Yeah, sure.
So it was that run where it was just relentless, not losing, winning a lot of those games. Motored by that British midfield we mentioned. Howard Wilkinson said they were an unstoppable force. Any team, this is a claim, any team would have challenged for the league with that midfield.
I mean, that's a lot of quality, to be fair.
It is, yeah. I mean, it's
quite well balanced.
Those are four, essentially, I mean, I hesitate to say Premier League, but you know what I mean by saying top division midfielders.
Yeah, absolutely. Like all pride of place to their international teams as well.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, Batty went on to win the title with Blackburn, I think he was there then. McAllister obviously did very well in a relatively underperforming Liverpool team.
Yeah, well, he won a treble, not the treble, but he won a treble.
That's right.
Does.
Obviously, Gary Speed, who, one of the, I think he played one of the most games in the Premier League
that's
history.
Right, yeah.
Maybe after Giggs.
Yeah.
It's a bit of a claim, but also it's kind of like, actually, it does stand up.
Yeah, sure. No, I think it's an accurate brag, if you can call it that.
Yeah. So Lee Chapman, as I mentioned off pod, who was a Panini golden ticket.
Yeah, I mean, no memory of him for me, but Lee Chapman.
So he was a classic centre-forward, English centre-forward.
Like Mark Hatley.
Yeah, kind of. Kind of like tall, chuck the ball up to him.
The English Carsten Janker.
I think he was a nice guy.
Bit of a yanker, but...
So he kind of like started, he played Forest before, he started in this season, kind of like busting around, giving defenders a hard time. He broke his wrist in the FA Cup tie with Liverpool, and Wilkerson acted quickly to bring in reinforcements. That was in January. The trump card was the signing of French forward Eric Cantona.
Wow. So Howard Wilkinson, take a bow.
So Mike was just quickly mentioned. Most people, I imagine, who are listening to a podcast on 1992 would probably know this. But in case you don't, Eric Cantona of Man United fame played first for half a season at Leeds.
I can't believe it was half a season. That has blown my mind.
So I think he came from, I want to say Nice or Montpellier.
So interestingly, talking about Cantona moving around a lot, he breaks through at Auxerre. Then he goes and plays for Martigues, who are like a second division French team, for one season. Marseille for two seasons. Bordeaux for one season. Montpellier for one season. Nîmes for one season. And then, or half a season, sorry. And then he comes over to Leeds. So he's a bit of a journeyman, even by the time he makes it to England.
I mean, is it a journeyman or does he just piss everyone off?
Yeah, it could be that as well. Which is crazy. Like, sorry, this is a big digression. Okay. But would you care to wager the most goals he ever scored in a season, in a league campaign?
20?
Less. 18 goals was his career high in a league in United, the 93-94 season.
Oh, wow.
Other than that, he's got like single figure goals for the majority of his season, wow. Which is a lot. I know he wasn't an out and out goal scorer, but that's still surprisingly low.
He tended to score worldies though, didn't he?
Yeah. Rather goals that stick in your mind.
The ones you remember. Yeah, I mean, interestingly, the next point here is Man United on League Cup final duty on April the 12th meant that Leeds leapfrogged them with a 3-0 victory, a game that saw Cantona score an outstanding individual goal.
Yeah.
And kind of announced himself as a bit of a worldy scorer. But United kept coming. Credit to the story of this season, the credit to United is that they didn't give up. And Ferguson, talking about this in one of his 500 autobiographies, he says that a lot of the lessons he learnt about fixture congestion and the hatred for the way that fixtures can kind of like piled up was this season and what they learnt, because they played 6 games in 3 weeks.
Bloody hell.
And this was, you know, before a serious European campaign.
Yeah, sure.
And the pressure ultimately told on them, and he commented about the fact that they simply didn't have the squad to cope.
It's crazy. You think of it more as a modern phenomenon, don't you? The kind of fixture congestion, but it's crazy it was happening.
I think
back
once Europe became a mainstay for English clubs, which, you know, eventually, especially for United, who kept winning the league, and before it was like, you know, 4 teams getting the Champions League. I think it was 1 or 2 in these early days. I think United would have had that most years, and they didn't really succeed in Europe for a while.
No, absolutely. And I guess a lot of the fixture congestion, because it's early 90s, would still have been like over the Christmas period, the pitches getting destroyed
Waterlogged
pitches.
Yeah, and playing no matter what.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's an element where this was a kind of like foreshadowing of what was coming with this, like you just talked about, squad rotation, larger squads, people kind of missing games out. Yeah. You know, ultimately, the League Cup becoming a little bit belittled in the earlier rounds, which eventually happens to the FA Cup as well.
Sure.
But that all kind of, you know, began around this period of time where forward-thinking managers like Ferguson, who were tasting a bit of success, were like, we can't do all these competitions.
Well, that's what starts his conversations with people like Nicky Butt, being like, you're not going to play for the next 2 weeks, but I've already earmarked you for three weeks' time, you're going to play against whoever. Yeah.
Which, 80s football, that is beyond the realm of understanding.
Yeah, well, we spoke about was it Villa who like only used something like 17 players in a whole Ipswich?
Yeah.
In a whole campaign or something like that. It's crazy.
Yeah, that is nuts. So yeah, you can almost already see on the cusp of the Premier League coming, you can see the game beginning to change, to modernise. As I say, a lot to do with the factors of Europe coming in. And the Champions League, I don't think it hadn't swelled to the size. Yeah,
I think it was still literally champions, wasn't it, at this point.
And knockout games.
Yeah, that's right.
Whereas the group thing and then the group into the group.
That was early 2000s, wasn't it? They tried to do 2 group stages, which was a bit random, terrible.
Yeah. But anyway, it was beginning to change. United kept coming, though, at Leeds, and they played those 6 games, and the pressure told on them in the penultimate week of the season. Manager Howard Wilkinson recalls that he was enjoying a quiet Sunday dinner with Leeds vice chairman Bill Fotherby and his wife after beating Sheffield United at 3-2 at Bramall Lane. So he went out for lunch. The United game was on, I think it was the 4 o'clock kickoff.
Right, okay.
So they'd won at 1:30, 4 o'clock, United were going to Liverpool, and they unexpectedly lost at Anfield. And during dinner, Liverpool went 2-0 up. They handed Leeds the title. Wilkinson's Sunday dinner fast became a title celebration before a civic reception the following day, hastily organised. So this Sunday dinner, that's all he remembers, is his Sunday dinner got completely ruined. The phone kept ringing, all the rest of it.
A true Brit.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Where they were greeted, it's amazing really. So they won it on the Sunday. The following day at Leeds Civic Town Hall, they were greeted by over 150,000 fans.
And all the local employers were like, where the hell of my staff.
Business plummeted.
Yeah.
The Leeds economy's never recovered. So yeah, Man United outdone by fixture congestion meant they were always behind Leeds on games played by at least 2 matches between February and April.
Yeah.
Which in some way you kind of think, oh, it's a bit of a advantage to know what you've got to do, but it's not really.
It's 2 sides of the same coin, isn't it? You can make an argument for both. Like, you know what you've got to do, but there's also a psychological advantage knowing if we slip up, they're already ahead of us.
Yeah, and I guess more likely to slip up when you're not getting the rest in between games.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, playing with 3 days between games, you know, once or twice, I guess, is okay. But non-stop.
Stacks up quick.
It's going to be a problem with a under-pressure squad. So Leeds pipped them as United ran out of steam. Ultimately, as we know, United's time would come very soon as Ferguson kind of shuffled his pack and strengthened his squad, one of them being Cantona the following November. But as for Leeds, the triumph restored pride in a club and a city that was down on its luck. The filmmaker, as I mentioned, Lee Hicken, he said, it touched the city a whole lot wider than just the football team. Before Wilkinson came along, fans were still harping back to the glory days and the city wasn't a particularly nice place to be. Leeds would have been early 70s.
Yeah, that's right.
With Norman Hunter, Chopper Harris, that team. There was a lot of hooliganism, as there had been across the country, and a lot of negative stuff surrounding the club. When Wilkinson came in, there was a block of time that not only transformed things on the pitch, but off the pitch as well. It changed the culture of the terraces at Elland Road, and the city started to pick up, and development started to happen that had never been there before. They were heroes of the city, that team. They were who you pretended to be in the playground.
Amazing.
Isn't that cool?
That's so cool. And that's why, it's part of why we love football, isn't it? It's these kind of stories where you're like, it doesn't matter. It's just a game. And yet it also does matter. And it's that wonderful like dichotomy of both things being true at the same time.
Yeah, definitely.
Where it's unimportant and yet massively important at the same time.
Hugely. And I think in particular, we're seeing in the kind of like the working class hubs.
Yeah, that's right.
Where football is... religion,
escapism, it
seems
it?
Like a, yeah, that's a better word. It's the thing. Yeah. It's the thing you talk about at work. It's the thing you talk about at the warehouse. It's the thing you talk about down the pub.
It was the thing that was accessible as well. Like, there wasn't a lot of money going around. There wasn't a lot of spare time.
Yeah.
If you're working, particularly, like, say, working class, a lot of manual jobs, that realistically, you don't have the energy or time to go and have other hobbies or money to have other hobbies.
Yeah.
It's a bit of a luxury that isn't afforded to you.
Definitely.
But going down to a pub and then to the terraces is kind of accessible for everyone.
Absolutely. And also the time, you know, the period of time that we're in British history, you're absolutely right. The working class was working class, not some, you know, much as the divide is now.
Yeah, sure.
And that, you know, these cities and the football clubs were the heartbeat of those communities.
Yeah.
So I can understand what he's saying there, and that being absolutely true. Like, you know, the idea now that Gordon Strachan and Gary McAllister were
heroes on the playground.
It doesn't
yeah.
make sense, but it does make sense for that time.
Yeah.
And ultimately Leeds, yeah, they claimed that league title. They wouldn't taste success really. They had their nights.
Yeah.
But they wouldn't taste success again.
Sure.
For absolutely, you know, years. And even then you're talking lower division titles. So fair play to Leeds United. They won the title and we move to significant, very significant others.
You just cannot write scripts like this.
So a couple of housekeeping before we get to the big story that happened in the season break between 92 and 93. Newly promoted Sheffield Wednesday finished third and secured UEFA Cup qualification. That's,
nice.
That's a story to carry on because we know that they have this ridiculous season next season in the Cups in particular with the Paul Warhurst legend. Chris Waddle was there by this time. John Sheridan, they had a pretty good kind of unknown team. So they'll come about. But the fact they got the UEFA Cup, I'd forgotten that.
Yeah, totally.
And finishing third ahead of Arsenal and Liverpool.
Amazing.
Interesting. The last day of the season saw Luton Town finally lose their top flight status after 10 seasons, the last six being involved in relegation battles.
It is crazy that they kept on getting the escape. It's the not waving but drowning, isn't it? It's like, oh, they're keeping afloat. That's good. It's like, oh, no. Their legs under the water kicking.
So they needed to win at Notts County and for Coventry to lose at Villa. Coventry did lose 2-0 at Villa, but unfortunately for Luton, they also lost 2-1, which kept Coventry up and Luton down. 17 years later, the Hatters, which is Luton Town's nickname, in case you didn't know, would fall into the Conference, the fifth level of English football system. And there's obviously a great comeback story because they are now back in the Premier League.
It's amazing. But,
you know, when you kind of like see these documentaries of like, oh, look at the state of Kenilworth Road.
Yeah, yeah.
That's why.
Because they sank like a stone.
Yeah, yeah, like, you know, 17 years from... you know, probably 20 years from winning the League Cup.
Yeah,
all the way down to the fifth level of English football.
But yeah, outside the kind of established EFL. It's
nuts,
crazy, isn't
absolutely
it?
Absolutely nuts. And then to come back up, which I'm sure we'll cover as we work through these years. But yeah, amazing story. Southampton's 21-year-old striker, Alan Shearer.
Here he is.
Was the target of much media speculation about a move to a leading First Division club. He was at Southampton, who were in the First Division. But obviously the likes of Liverpool, Man United, Arsenal were strongly linked with his signature during the autumn of 91.
Yeah.
But Shearer decided to stay put, interestingly, on the South Coast before making a decision about his future at the end of the season. He was later capped for the senior England side for the first time in February 1992 and scored on his debut.
I didn't know he was at Southampton when he got his debut.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah. He actually stayed at Southampton a little bit longer.
Right.
Which was interesting again, which we'll cover no doubt. But despite being linked then, he didn't move until a couple of years later, obviously, to Blackburn.
Yeah, that's right. Which turned out to be a good decision.
It did.
Sensible career management, didn't it?
It did, yeah. Really interesting kind of decision-making.
Yeah.
You know, for an ambitious guy who was obviously going to succeed.
Yeah.
But yeah, he stayed at Southampton for a little bit. Man United's teenage winger, Ryan Giggs, who had only played twice for the first team the previous season, received plaudits for his outstanding performances and picked up PFA Young Player of the Year award.
Nice. Which obviously saw Lee Sharp very upset and lose his place in United.
Yeah, there's a bit of rivalry, wasn't
yeah,
there?
That's yeah, right.
And then Sharp ended up switching to the right to be accommodated.
Oh, that's right, yeah. Which was a bit
weird, really. I mean, in a way, like, Sharp was never the same after Giggs arrived.
No, and also, probably. Like, Giggs is a generational talent. It's a bit gutting sometimes, isn't it, when you've got these good players where you're like, you are an established, like, top four kind of player.
Yeah.
And, oh, okay, Messi's come over and taken your place or
you made Giggs into Messi there, but...
Hey, I mean, to United fans, he's as close as they got.
Yeah, maybe. So, yeah, he won Young Player of the Year award. He won as a League Cup winner's medal, establishing himself as a regular player in the top division before his 18th birthday, which under 10 players have done.
Yeah, sure.
You know, yeah, obviously you go to Owen and Rooney, but there aren't many others. Walcott, no. I think.
But no, not by 17. He wasn't an established. No. He broke through at Southampton.
Sven took him on a jolly, didn't he?
When he was 16, yeah. Never played him. Yeah. I mean... Oh, what a curse, really, to lay on Walcott.
It was, yeah.
Because it just felt like a stunt, didn't it? Just the idea to bring him and then not even use him.
It was weird. Really weird move. I've never understood that. I've never heard it explained. I don't know what he makes of it now, but very strange for Walcott. Other young players who made the headlines this season, kind of establishing the next decade coming about. This season were Liverpool's teenage winger, Steve McManaman,
yes,
who I didn't realise arrived that early.
Yeah, I knew he was a teenage prodigy.
New signing, Rob Jones.
Yeah.
Aston Villa's Dwight York and Nottingham Forest midfielder, Roy Keane.
Oh, yeah, Keane. I forgot he comes over.
So Keane, obviously, we covered it in a previous episode. He played in the 91 Cup final, which neither you or I realised in the Gaza final. But he was firmly established now as a Clough favourite and obviously would make his way over to United, I think, at the end of next season.
Imagine that, playing like your first, not first manager, but in England, your first manager being Cloughy and your next being Sir Alex Ferguson.
It's not bad, is it? Yeah, it's not bad at all. Although well, very different characters.
But, yeah, true.
Yeah. So, yeah, Ian Wright was top scorer with 29 goals.
Oh, righty, so close, yet so far.
So, not quite legendary status. I didn't realise he moved to Arsenal mid-season.
No, I didn't, actually.
Yeah, so that's 29 goals combined.
Right, okay.
Palace and Arsenal. But yeah, it was all change, you know, in the kind of makeup of the players coming through. A lot of those names there are like, right, they're 90s footballers.
We're going to be talking about them a lot over the next 10 seasons.
Absolutely. Yet this is 1992 and they're all beginning to break through. Some of them, you know, very young players, McManaman, Giggs, Jones. But some of them kind of like Wrighty, who obviously broke into football a lot later. Establishing himself. But it was all change as this new era crept up in football. We just kind of feel like it's right to end the podcast talking about this. So I've got like... you know, the breakdown of the story. So jump in as you see fit. But for those who didn't know, the Division One, the setup of the English Football League changed and the Premier League began in 1992. Now, the backdrop of that is during the 1980s, major English clubs had begun to transform into business ventures, applying commercial principles to the way their clubs were run to maximise revenue, essentially putting kind of like going after money, not necessarily ahead of the football yet.
No, but it becomes a decision maker of sorts,
definitely,
it?
Yeah, in the way they were going about things. So this was led majorly by David Dean at Arsenal and Martin Edwards at United.
Yeah.
In the way that they were kind of like, you know, this is how we want to set up. And obviously other of the bigger teams... who at the time would have been, you know, Spurs scholar at Spurs. You had Everton, who were a big team at the time. Ironically, that kind of fell away, but they were in the room.
Yeah, of course.
I think there's a meeting we talk about in a minute where Everton were one of the six teams represented,
right,
which is random, really, because that fell away pretty quickly.
I was about to say, yeah, it's just hindsight you realise.
Yeah.
It was one of those things where it's like, oh, Everton just in a bit of a lull, but they'll be back.
I just wonder if there was a moment where it was like, what are you doing?
Awkward. Just be like, I haven't seen you guys in months. And then he overhears a conversation being like, oh, last week at the golf course was great, wasn't it? He's like, hold on, on there. One of those awkward, like, let's have a second group.
Definitely. Evans Chairman comes in, like, wearing a crappy suit. Like, mate, what are you doing here? What are you doing here with that?
Remove him from the Top Boys.
That's right.
Group thread.
Yeah. Yeah, what's that? Yeah.
Let's start Top Boys 2.0.
So Dean and Edwards, among other people, they demanded that television companies should pay more for the coverage. And that was a large part of it was TV.
Yeah.
They recognised that there was a growing hunger. And we've talked about the fact that live football wasn't a major factor, which is weird, but it wasn't. Sure. So that companies should pay more for their coverage of football matches and revenue from television grew in importance. So this is interesting. The Football League received £6.3 million for a two-year agreement in 1986. Mm-hmm. 6.3. In 1988, a deal with ITV was agreed. The price had risen to £44 million.
It's a big leap, isn't it?
Incredible,
that's
man.
That's a huge leap.
Like nearly £40 million increase in a two-year gap. Over 4 years, so that would take them through until 1992, which is where we are. According to Irving Scholar, the Spurs owner at the time, he was involved in the negotiations of television deals. Each of the first division clubs received only £25,000 per year.
No way.
Isn't that incredible?
What a pittance.
So from television rights, before 1986, this increased to only 50,000 in the 86 negotiation.
Wow.
And then 600,000 in 1988.
There we go.
Now, to put into perspective, that bought you a player.
Yeah, sure.
You know, Lineker to Everton, to Barcelona, 800,000.
Yeah.
So your TV money bought you a striker.
Sure.
A top striker. Yeah. But a striker, one player. So the 1988 negotiations were conducted ultimately under the threat of 10 clubs leaving to form a Super League.
Yeah.
Heard that before.
Mm-hmm.
But they were eventually persuaded to stay, with the top clubs taking the lion's share of the deal. Interesting again.
Yeah.
By the beginning of the 1990s, so there's a major factor that comes in and changes things here, which is the Taylor Report.
Right.
So for those that don't know, the Taylor Report was the report that came about as a result of the Hillsborough disaster, mm-hmm, for changes to safety in stadiums that had to be made by law. So the Taylor Report instructed stadium upgrades to the top division.
Yeah.
So you couldn't be in the top division if your stadium wasn't to a certain level.
That's right, yeah. The abolition of standings as well.
The major thing, which is a massive expense. There was loads of other stuff as well about, you know, access and emergency exits services and all the rest of it. But the major one was standing room was outlawed and you had to have seating. So you can imagine that is a huge expense. So you had the TV money thing coming in. You had these clubs kind of now facing a major outlay. I think they had 3 years to get this stuff done. So then in 1990, the managing director of LWT, Greg Dyke,
mm-hmm,
who some of you might recognise, who became the head of the FA, a major kind of player in these upper discussions about football in the future that came. He met with representatives of the big five football clubs in England, Man United, Liverpool, Spurs, Arsenal and Everton.
Yeah.
Who, in 1990, that was the
big
five.
Yeah, of course,
Which is interesting. He met with them over a dinner, quite an informal thing. So it wasn't like a, you know, this is it. So he is just a managing director of a television company at this point. The meeting was to pave the way for a breakaway from the Football League.
Yeah.
Dyke believed that it would be more lucrative for the LWT if only the large clubs in the country were featured on national television. So he was only interested in the big clubs.
Yeah.
He didn't want Palace versus Luton.
Yeah, sure.
He wanted, you know, Spurs versus Arsenal, United versus Liverpool, all the rest of it. So he kind of was looking to cut a deal. Unfortunately, the league would have no credibility without the backing, and David Dean kind of pulled the plug going, we need the FA.
Yeah.
Now, again, David Dean was quite in with the FA. I think he later became some kind of director of the FA.
He might have done. He was heavily, heavily involved. Yeah.
So there's a good link there. So it's a bit of an elongated story, but it kind of is how the whole thing came about. So David Dean went and had talks with the FA. They were receptive to the idea, or maybe recognised it was, mm-hmm, going to happen one way or another.
Sure.
So they were either on, you know, on the boat, or they were getting left behind. But they didn't have, this is ridiculous, the FA didn't have an amicable relationship with the Football League.
Yeah.
Which is a different thing
for
those of you that don't know. So the Football League, the Division 1, 2, 3, 4, is different to the FA, mm-hmm, that govern the entire game in England. And considered it, so they were on board with the game, with the breakaway league, because it would weaken the position of the Football League.
Crazy, isn't it? To have your internal leagues at war with one another.
Yeah.
Which is still happening at the moment. It's really,
of course it is, yeah.
It's really topical to bring up now, but there's obviously this massive argument at the moment where the Premier League is arguing over the 900 million that should filter down into the lower leagues.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, of course, yeah.
It's literally happening at the moment where 10 clubs have voted against dishing out that kind of money.
Yeah.
We won't bore people with that now, but it's still interesting, isn't it?
Still going
30 years later.
Yeah, and money's at the heart of it. That's the heart of all these conversations is, you know, what way is going to make the most money.
Exactly.
The FA want to make more money. Didn't necessarily see why the Football League took such a big share of things. We're not really, they're kind of the label for the division.
Yeah, yeah.
But they weren't the governing body. Yeah, loads of stuff going on. So they were ultimately like, yeah, we'll jump on board with this league idea because the Football League would be left kind of floundering a little bit. So at the close of the 1991 season, which is amazing, it's only one season before it happened, which I find nuts. I said to you last week, didn't I, that this had to have been agreed a few seasons before. Yeah. Not the case. A proposal was tabled for the establishment of a new league that would bring more money into the game overall. The founder members agreement signed on the 17th of July 1991, simply 1 year before it started, by the game's top flight clubs established the basic principles for setting up the FA Premier League. The newly formed top division was to have commercial independence from the Football Association and the Football League, which is huge.
Yeah.
Giving the FA Premier League license to negotiate its own broadcast and sponsorship agreements, which ultimately paved the way for the game we know today.
Yeah, it cannot be underestimated how much this changes the global standing of football.
Yeah.
Football literally does. The reason that the 92 gets joked about, as in like, oh, football changed and became modern, is because of everything you've just described there. Yeah. This changes the history of football. And we see now that the reason that the Europa League, the Europa Conference League, the Champions League is always filled with British teams.
Yeah,
but like give or take, it's because of the financial disparity now between even the top teams in Italy, in Spain, in France, compared to the gargantuan money that England has, and it's because of this decision here.
Well, interestingly, at the time in 1992, the argument given at the time that the extra income would allow English clubs to compete with teams across Europe.
Yeah, sure.
Which, ironically, was also by Dyke stated that would then in time strengthen the English national team, which didn't happen.
Yeah,
really.
Sure. No.
Like, you could argue now it might do, but the golden generation, as they're known, were ultimately a failure.
Absolutely.
Which would have been a generation past this, and it didn't come about. But, you know, that might be to do with a whole different thing with English psyche and all the rest of it. But, you know, ultimately, English teams did compete across Europe.
Yeah.
And by the end of this decade, obviously, United would have won the Champions League.
We don't look back.
No, exactly. So that was a big part of the argument. Although Greg Dyke played a significant role in the creation of the Premier League, he and ITV, of which LWT was a part of, lost out in the bidding for broadcast rights when it came down to it because a new lad came to town.
B Sky B.
B Sky B.
He's the jock, isn't he? He's just walking in, just pushing over ITV, just giving BBC a backhand, being like, the big boys are in now.
With his daddy's allowance falling out of his pockets. So just to bear in mind, Lou was talking about how this changed the game. So in 1988, £66 million secured the deal. B Sky B won with a bid of £304 million.
That is insane, isn't it?
So that is a 300% increase.
Absolutely incredible.
So absolutely nuts. BBC were awarded the highlights package, broadcast on Match of the Day, which would change hands a few times over the decades, but ultimately it stayed with Sky. I know it's kind of split now. So as contrast, as we finish this, you know, ridiculous thing that now begins a new era of the Premier League, £304 million over 5 years, B Sky B in 1992. In 2023, so 30 years later, 40 years later, Sky Sports, TNT Sports, and the BBC split the live and highlights rights for a combined £6.7 billion.
You couldn't, even though they clearly saw the direction it was going, I don't think they ever thought it would get to the monstrosity it is now.
It's insane.
It is just undeniable, isn't it? It's unstoppable.
Yeah. I mean, it's got to be one of the biggest markets in the world.
Yeah,
isn't it?
Without a shadow of a doubt. Yeah.
And that's just UK.
Yeah.
That's not where else it's shown.
And ironically, I've mentioned this before, and it's a bit of a geeky thing, but it cannot be understated. What the Premier League did once they got this is the domestic rights were bought, but they said, we will give the international rights away for free. The first three seasons, I think it was, they didn't charge any foreign TV for broadcasting their games, which obviously then teams
sell the product.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Other countries go, oh, we've got a bit of a gap here. What should we do? Oh, we can use, you know, these big teams in England for free.
Yeah.
And then people get hooked. People see it's a good product. And then all of a sudden, once they've started filling their schedules with all these TVs regularly, it suddenly becomes like, okay, now you owe us money. Or like from this season on, you need to pay for the broadcast rights.
Yeah, very clever.
And that's why the Premier League is the most watched league in the world. Because at the time, like, Italy was still by far the best league in the world.
Well, it wasn't particularly trendy, the Premier League. And we'll cover that, no doubt. Like, the first few seasons of the Premier League are a little bit they're quite old school English.
It's interesting, isn't it? The business side of it is looking forward into the decade. The football is still very much looking backwards. It's still not, like you say, it takes a long while for England to kind of catch up to the continent. It takes like another 6-7 years, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll track that, no doubt. But for now, 1992, the forgotten miracle.
Oh, congratulations, Leeds. I feel like we didn't really talk about it, but well done.
Yeah, Lee Chapman, Gary Speed, Gordon Strachan.
Oh, yeah. Gary McAllister.
That's right. And Harold Wilkinson, but ultimately forgotten as the juggernaut that was the Premier League would begin.
With that, please join us next week. If you want to leave us a rate and review, that will always be appreciated. But join us next week as we look at the Premier League and what it becomes.